Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene! Gene Fodor!
Gene, what's good?
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano! Huh?
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elia Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
Well, how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas.
And you know, Julie, in science fiction, we keep coming back to this idea of like humans going out into the void and encountering another intelligent species.
Yes.
And then figuring out what's going to go down. And it's just throughout the genre, but
it's a trope.
It's definitely a trope. It's tropey even. But the really fascinating thing to me is to look backwards in time and think about humans and their interactions with other human-like beings,
right?
Such as most famously the Neanderthal.
Neanderthal.
Yeah, the Neanderthal, which is typically spelled, I mean, it's spelled like it's Neanderthal, and I've been saying it wrong for ages, but of course, as you pointed out, it comes from the German, so it's Neanderthal.
Yes.
So,
which is fun to say it that way,
it's,
too.
It rolls off the tongue a lot easier if you just go ahead and use the fake German, accent that we all have gotten off of the television. And just say Neanderthal. But we can't do the entire podcast in that voice.
Oh my God, you sound eerily like Arnold Schwarzenegger right now.
I think I was listening to a mix recently that had a bunch of Arnold like fitness samples. So that was probably what did it.
Yep.
But anyway, Neanderthal. Hopefully that pronunciation won't annoy you too much, in this podcast. Likewise, we are going to steer largely clear of another problem that you encounter when you start reading about Neanderthals or any topics concerning the ascension of man and human evolution. And that is that you almost always get bogged down in discussion of dig sites and all these Latin names for the different fossils. And it's all very important to a larger understanding, but we're going to try and steer clear of a lot of that.
Because it's like the book of Genesis.
Yeah,
when it comes to that.
It is. It begins like, and then Homo epicatus, emerged from Homo elliptus, and we don't know where Homo caffacatus fits in. You know, it gets a little dry. Even for me, and I've written some articles about this before, and it just, you know, it kind of stuns your brain after a while. But
so for our purposes, we're gonna
sort of blow through some of that.
Yeah.
But there are lots of great resources out there. That'll hit you with the Latin names if you like. But to really put us in more of a time and place, let's talk about what the Neanderthals were.
Yeah.
All right. They first
hominids.
They are hominids. They would have looked very much like people, like modern humans, even like right. If you get in your mind this sort of idea of like a troll like Ron Perlman esque hulking thing, or Tom Waits, you can put that in as well.
Okay,
it's like that's not necessarily a good model to have, and it's a really hard one to kick. Like when I think Neanderthal, it's really hard to kick that idea of this hulking brute that's stomping through the underbrush.
Right, it's that cartoon caveman with a club thing.
Yeah, yeah. And it's hard to get past that. But these guys would have looked more or less like modern humans, only shorter, heavier built, mm-hmm. Stronger, particularly in the arms and hands.
Mm-hmm.
So they were kind of thick and muscly dudes.
Yeah, actually, I read somewhere, too, that their rib cages were really large and they didn't have much of a waist.
Yeah.
Which was sort of like, it gives you this idea of these barrel-chested, really compact, muscular beings.
Yeah. And, kind of like, I guess kind of like a stumpy wrestler physique to a certain extent. The skull evidence we have show that they didn't have much of a chin, and their foreheads were kind of sloped backwards.
Yeah.
Their brain case was lower, but longer, and it housed a slightly larger brain than what we're carrying around today.
Right, which was really great for them, helped them survive for a very long time, but also, as we'll get into later, may have contributed a bit to their downfall as well.
Yeah. So these guys first showed up in Europe as early as 600,000 or 350,000 years ago. We're a little, anytime you deal with the fossil record,
yeah,
you're dealing with bits and pieces of a jigsaw puzzle, and many of the pieces we'll just never have. So it's always a little touch and go. And it's if you don't understand that, it can be a little frustrating where you're like, how can we not know? You know, like, how can we just dig up some more bones? Well, not all bones survive. Not all bones become fossils.
Yeah, it's a game of chance, right? Like, even the Neanderthal man who was discovered, it was sort of by chance because the guy who saw it was about to pitch it. And then he thought, well, maybe that's a bear skull. And he was collecting animal skulls and ended up keeping it. And then they found out later that, oh, no, this is not a bear skull. So, again, I mean, our knowledge would have been so incomplete if he hadn't had that chance encounter.
Yeah. So these guys pretty much ruled Eurasia for 200,000 years, roaming around, doing their thing. And even at the height of their occupation of, say, Western Europe, scientists think that they probably never really exceeded, say, 15,000 total. So, we're not dealing with modern population levels of human. Like today, humans are really off the chart, I mean, we're an exceedingly successful species. You could argue we're an invasive species pretty much everywhere. But this was a time when populations could not really reach the unsustainable levels that we've managed to achieve today.
Right. And from fossil records, what we do know is that the time that, Neanderthals went extinct, humans were really, Homo sapiens were really starting to make great gains. So, of course, that's where that idea developed where we just vanquished the Neanderthals and ate them and mated with them and left them in the dirt. And that's not really true.
Yeah, it's kind of like this will probably be the only time I use a Will Smith quote, but, there's this idea that the Neanderthals were old and busted and the humans were the new hotness. And that we just eradicated the old and busted Neanderthals. So it's just, they were just this was the old model. The new model's so much better. So of course the old model's going to die out.
Right, right.
But the more you really look at it, the more it becomes a situation where you have two really good models. I mean, it's kind of like the idea that, I think it was actually Ricky Gervais who pointed out that like the garden slug. May look disgusting, we may hate it, but the garden slug is perfect. Like nature has filled that niche with something that really works well. So like nature does, by and large, doesn't create, evolution does not lead to ineffective designs. It's like, this is the pinnacle. This is a great design. So the more you look at it, you have a situation where the Neanderthal is a killer design, but circumstances, ended up, having this other design, this human design be the one it's going to take the lead. It's
going
to become the dominant force.
And a lot of that had to do with climate, right? Like the time that they were flourishing, Neanderthals, they had adapted to their environment really well.
Yeah.
But I'm jumping ahead here.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and two other key things to mention is that there's a really old, outdated idea that's still probably kicking around in a lot of people's heads, and that is that we evolved from Neanderthal, and that's completely not true. Rather, we share a common relative, a common ancestor.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were to follow the chart back, you'd say, hey, here's this particular species.
Right.
And at this point it diverged, and its ancestors became Neanderthals and became humans.
Right. So there's Homo erectus, right? And then
right.
There's the branch of Homo heidelbergensis. Am I saying that right?
Uh-huh. Which I just picture a caveman in Lederhosen.
I know. Yeah. That's what Heidelberg. And then of course that species evolved into Neanderthals.
Right. Yeah. It's like the same thing that we share a common ancestor with a chimpanzee.
Right.
But we did not evolve from a chimpanzee. So if you had any of that kicking around your head, get rid of that.
Yeah. Like 99.9% of our genetic material is shared with Neanderthals.
Yes.
Yeah.
And another interesting fact to keep in mind is that again, we coexisted with Neanderthals for a brief period of time,
right?
As far as evolutionary history goes, but we did coexist,
right? They became extinct about 30,000 years ago.
Yeah,
right.
And they may have survived in some very remote areas, mm-hmm. for perhaps up to 24,000 years ago, and that's specifically Gibraltar.
Yeah.
You know, in the Strait of Gibraltar, there's a site there called Gorman's Cave that people have studied a lot. So this is an isolated area that you know, it's just an island. They end up there and they end up holding out there for a while. But eventually, they're out and we're in.
But what I find really interesting is that Neanderthals got a bad rap because they weren't these great bedazzlers.
Oh, yeah, because
right?
they're like, well, where are their cave drawings?
Yeah.
Where are their
beads and where's their jewelry? So at that time, that was the litmus test of whether or not you were sophisticated enough to be thought of as cool as Homo sapiens, right?
Right.
And so that really did contribute to this idea of them as knuckle draggers, actually,
mm-hmm.
which is unfortunate because they are so much more nuanced than that. And in fact, it reminds me of Kazuo Ishiguro's Never Let Me Go, the novel about the clone children.
Yes. This is my wife read this for book club. And it's basically the same plot as the old sci-fi film Parts the Clonishar, which they did for MST3K. And also there was some, what was that? The Island.
Yeah.
Basically, you know, the idea of like, oh, let's have clones of ourselves so we can have spare parts.
Yeah, right. So we can just pick up this organ from this person. But one of the central topics in the book is that the children must produce artwork to prove their own humanity.
Hmm.
And so I was thinking about that. I was thinking, well, that's the same case with Neanderthals, is that we thought, well, we don't see any cave paintings. Therefore, they must have been brutes. They must have been without sympathy or, you know, these higher ideas of our emotions and our humanity. But we'll find this out later. That's not the case at all.
Yeah. Well, also, it's important to note that some of the early cave drawings that you encounter, like pictures of animals, you know, pictures of prey.
Yeah.
And they think that a lot of that is probably used to teach.
This presentation is brought to you by Intel, sponsors of tomorrow.
So it's not like they were like, oh, I have free time. I must create some art. Let me draw an antelope. Isn't it beautiful? No, it was probably more like I'm really trying to drive home to you how to hunt an antelope,
right.
Kid. Let me draw one on the wall.
Yeah, this isn't cubism here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think we can sort of get a little, a little lofty about our ideas concerning early primitive artwork.
Yeah, and you've touched on this too as well, is that the superiority myth. This mm-hmm. idea that Homo sapiens are really the only cool kids in town because they mastered fire, can speak,
agriculture.
We can use tools, agriculture, so on and so forth.
Yeah, and it really kind of flows into sort of a manifest destiny. That, you know, this idea that we're special, we've got to be special. We're here. We must be the superior design. There could not possibly be a better one.
Right. And that's the cool thing about looking at this and thinking about it in the context. We are the cool kids here right now, but, 200,000 years from now, they'll be looking back at us saying, what in the world were they doing?
Yeah. We, Neanderthals first met our human ancestors in the Middle East about 130,000 years ago. And perhaps perhaps after about a 500,000 years mm-hmm. of separation.
Right.
When they split off from that common ancestor. Then they contacted each other again in Eurasia roughly 45,000 years ago. And this is where we end up in, you know, and there are a lot of questions about what these contacts consisted of.
Mm-hmm.
For one thing, you know, those cave drawings that we've mentioned, you don't see any cave drawings of Neanderthals. So it's not like they were just running into each other at the supermarket all the time. Again,
right.
we're dealing with small populations of people that moved around for the most part. So,
yeah, they were nomadic, yeah.
Yeah, nomadic people. So it's not, again, it's not like they would run into each other all the time. And even human populations were likely to be running into, you run into a group that speaks differently, that are very alien from you.
Right.
That are maybe just as alien from you as these, slightly heavy set guys who look pretty intimidating and look like they could really take you down with a tackle if need be.
But we now know that we, humans tangoed with Neanderthals, and by tango,
yes.
I mean, they had sex with each other.
Yeah, at least some. It apparently happened.
Yeah.
Yeah. The genetic evidence is there. Did it happen all the time? No, it didn't. I mean, it's not the kind of thing that is happening all the time.
No, and in fact, if that were the case, then we would have a lot more evidence in our own DNA,
right?
Right now, we've got traces of 2 to 4% of Neanderthals in the modern human genome
mm-hmm.
in populations outside of Africa, which is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's some evidence there that, again, they tangoed. And this we learned from the Max Planck Institute. Because they sequenced the Neanderthal genome.
That's right.
Yeah. And they also found out that they were pale-skinned and they had a range of colors.
Including red hair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they shared the language gene with us.
Yeah.
Which is FOXP2, right?
Yeah, that's the one. In fact, there have been some arguments that they may have... They may have communicated musically. Do you remember this from our research for the music healing the mind?
Yeah, can music rebuild your brain?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was the bone flute.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was something like, I don't know, was it 50,000 years ago or 50,000 mm-hmm. year old instrument?
Yeah.
That is clearly, it's intentional in its marking. Some people have said, oh, animals made the holes in the bone. But if you look at the pictures of it, like the holes are pretty exact.
Yeah.
So it's not too far off to think that they'd be able to use it as a musical instrument.
There are also, you also see different examples of cannibalistic there's some examples of possible cannibalism
right.
among Neanderthals and also some evidence in with the bones to suggest that humans may have eaten Neanderthals mm-hmm. at different times and possibly made necklaces out of their children's teeth.
Oops.
Yeah, which is just going to happen. I mean, to call back to another podcast, we have the whole cannibalism podcast where we dealt primarily with cannibalism in nature.
Right.
So if you haven't listened to that one, if you were like my wife, you were scared off from it thinking it was going to be mainly about people eating other people, it's really mostly about animals eating their own type.
Praying mantises offering themselves up in a love
yeah,
ritual
yeah.
to get their heads bitten off.
Yeah, lots of sexual cannibalism and that kind of thing in that
yeah.
podcast. But one of the things we really tried to drive home in that was that cannibalism, when you strip away all of the modern human
taboos
and all, it really makes a lot of sense. So it's just... The idea that you would encounter it.
That doesn't mean that we're suggesting do it. But
no.
In the context of when it happened, it made sense, right? Because they're hearty protein sources.
Yeah. And, you know, it's otherwise that stuff's going to go to waste and you might starve to death. So, of course, you eat it. There are also some arguments out there that these early groups, including Neanderthals, also partook of some scavenging. So it's
yeah.
also in a situation where there's some war dead, either on your, you know, from your own tribe or
mm-hmm.
from this group that you just had a little... miscommunication with. Again, why let the vultures have that when those are some vital nutrients that could sustain you as you continue to scour the landscape for what will hopefully be your next meal.
Right. And talking about miscommunication or communication makes me again think of the speech gene and the fact that because they had the large brains and they had that gene, and because they also had a tiny bone in the throat called the hyoid,
mm-hmm.
Which supports the soft tissue of the throat and it holds the root of the tongue in place, which is a requirement for speech, makes me think that, and many others, that they did have some sort of language.
Mm-hmm.
What we do know is that their larynx is much higher in their throat than humans, which would have limited some of their speech, but it's good to note that because again, that that would have helped them to have survived, to be able to communicate with one another. But in the long run, it may have actually contributed to their demise in terms of Homo sapiens.
Well, and also we've seen plenty of evidence that just because, I mean, even just among Homo sapiens, just because one group can talk to the other doesn't mean the other group isn't going to attempt to wipe them out.
No, yeah, and that's, it was more in the, we'll talk about it later, but it was more in the context of, are you better suited to survive if you can communicate really well with each other?
Mm-hmm.
But another thing about Neanderthals that that the veil has been lifted on is tool making.
Yes.
And some other skills and things that they've done. Again, it was thought that humans had the upper hand with tools, but it turns out that Neanderthals were just as sophisticated with their tools. And in some cases, the shales or the blades were a lot more effective than the Homo sapiens. So there you go. Mad skills.
Yeah. These guys were hunters. These guys made glue.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is pretty amazing.
It's, yeah. Do you mind if I talk about
that?
Because I was so amazed by this. The glue is made from tightly rolled strips of birch bark, and it's deposited into a hole in the ground. And then they cover that with earth and they seal out the oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
Then they take a smoldering stick, put that in there. And, because the birch is deprived of oxygen, it sweats out pitch. And so when it cools, it can be used in tools to bond materials together. And the even cooler thing about it is that you can take that piece of cooled pitch and take it anywhere. Of course, they're pneumatic, right? So mm-hmm. they're going to bring it with them. And then all you have to do is reheat it, to use it again. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because I can't remember if this was a PBS special. I'll have to look at my research notes. But, the video clip that I saw of this, it was really difficult for them to do and to do right. So it took a lot of skill and it took a lot of trial and error. And even in this day and age, for you and I to try to do this, I'm sure there'd be a lot of expletives flying. You know, there'd be a steep learning curve.
Yeah.
So for them to be able to do this is amazing.
Yeah. I can barely cook dinner for myself without, resorting to cursing. So I can't imagine making glue in my backyard.
I know. I remember your risotto stirring
technique
needed some observation by a second party. So
yes.
I
cook best when I'm helping and not taking the lead.
You're more of a sous chef.
Yeah.
There's no shame in that. Sous chef, that's an important role. But they also used pollen. A lot of pollen was found in the caves.
Mm-hmm.
And that was used as an antiseptic and a salve.
And speaking of pollen, it's worth pointing out that they were not specifically carnivorous.
Yeah.
It seems like meat was a big part of their diet. They were probably steak fans and would have been found frequenting Outback if they were around today. but they did eat vegetable matter. They did scavenge for seeds when they were available. So.
Yeah, and that's right. They found some plant matter in the molars.
Mm-hmm.
And again, here you have this idea of them as being these, you know, cavemen who were just, you know, and then of course they were taking down some large animals, but they weren't, you know, primarily carnivorous. So this idea of
them, they invented the blooming onion, actually. Not many people really know that, but,
they did. You just threw me there. I'm like, now I'm imagining them over the fire with their blooming onions. I'm salivating a little bit, and that's just so wrong. But the other thing is a lot of people thought of them as sort of like the dirty hippies too of hominids.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, the hygiene thing has been brought up before, that their teeth has shown very little decay.
Yeah.
So they were taking care of their teeth in some manner.
Well, and it's also a lot easier to take care of your teeth if you don't have a huge sugar diet. So, you know, these guys, you know, aside from some nuts and berries here and there, you know, they're probably not, sucking down as much sugar as modern humans do.
Yeah. They're probably whittling their own little toothpicks too.
Yeah.
Actually, we don't have any evidence of that, but I'd like to imagine that.
So in thinking about like how this human or human-like population grew and expanded and eventually dwindled and disappeared, you really have to think of it in terms of geology, climate, and resources.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're talking about long stretches of time here, hundreds of thousands of years, during which the Earth's climate kind of whopped around back and forth, kind of like a ping pong ball, where you had periods of cooling, and then you had periods of heat.
Right.
You had some glacial stuff mixed in there. And when the weather changes, it changes the geology.
Right.
And
the
landscape. And over long periods of time, of course, as geology changes, it changes the weather. So these are all things that are in flux, and they force, in the same way that, that you see, like populations of birds moving around, looking at global warming and climate mm-hmm. change, you know, you see how populations of animals are affected. And at this time, I mean, humans were very much, humans are susceptible to this even now, but at the time, if animals had to move to a different geographical location, then humans were forced into that area as well.
Right. I mean, and just to put it into context too, the global warming that we experience now is different from what they were experiencing in terms of extreme climate changes.
Yes.
So the Neanderthals, they survived the Ice Age. They did really well with that. They became very compact and muscular, right?
Right.
But then at some point, the climates kept changing very quick, and within, you know, a span of a lifetime, a lot of their landscape could have changed. And in fact, we know it changed.
Yeah.
So the forests that they relied on may have receded, and all of a sudden they have less area to hunt in.
Yeah. And, this really boils down to two areas that really stuck out to me, about how these changes in climate affected them. All right. One key thing to look at is that Neanderthals, as far as we know, never took to farming, never took up agriculture,
right.
Which of course was and continues to be a vital part of modern humanity.
Yeah. And keep in mind, they're nomadic too, right?
Yeah. So. They're nomadic. And again, agriculture is the thing that, you know, made us settle down.
Right.
And then ultimately led to the construction of villages and cities that gave us the free time to specialize in different skills,
mm-hmm.
And allowed, like, you know, one old dude to just sit around the village all day painting stuff.
Making those cool cave paintings.
Yeah. Or making little gold frogs or something. But Neanderthals never took to the agricultural way of life. For the greater part of their Eurasian dominance, the climate was harsher and more sporadic than it was today. So it just wasn't a good time to get into farming.
Right.
Even if they'd wanted to, they were smart enough to, they were skilled enough to. So it wasn't a situation where they would have been like, what is carrot? How me plant? You know, it wouldn't have been a situation like that. But the time was not right for the agricultural leap.
Right. And well, they were so tethered to their own physicality too, right?
Right. Yeah. And when conditions improved, when it did become farming
right.
time, there wasn't that much really pushing them to leave behind these hunting and gathering techniques that worked well for them.
Right, because I was thinking about it, that scientists put that the extreme climate changes about 45,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
They became extinct about 30,000 years ago.
Yeah.
So for 15,000 years in crazy climates, they still had a toehold in it, right?
Yeah.
They were still existing. But eventually, you're going to die off. And, you know, you're going to lose that toehold. And, those great stocky limbs that you had are going to be problematic because they require
yeah.
more calories to upkeep, and there's less protein sources around, right? Less
right.
forest.
And that body style that they had, that meaty, tough, wrestler build, the main way that this suited them, was in ambushing their prey.
Yeah.
They were used to dealing with wooded or semi-wooded areas, somewhere, you know, they can hide in cover, wait till that deer, that ibex, or that blooming onion comes in close enough, you know, wait in the cover and then leap out and really throw down with that deer.
So it was like a wrestler on the ropes.
Right. Yeah.
About to come down.
Yeah. He's like, he's on the ropes. Let's get him. And then they, you know, just beat the crap out of the deer, or more like, you know, they do spears and whatnot. But they've also found injuries in some of the Neanderthals that they say resemble rodeo rider.
that's right.
Injuries. So just imagine it's like you have a pretty dangerous animal, perhaps with big horns,
mm-hmm.
Or antlers. And these guys, and again, they probably would not go after some of the larger, like, megafauna.
Mm-hmm.
They probably would not be hunting a rhinoceros or something like that, but something like a deer and ibex. So they hide. It comes into range. They jump out. They surround it, and they just start attacking.
Now, is there a clown in this scenario?
I hope so. I hope that there was like a Neanderthal early clowning.
Clown, yeah.
That's why they didn't paint rocks. Their art was maybe all about painting themselves.
They were performance artists. But yeah, that's interesting that you bring up the injury too, because I remember reading that those injuries were oftentimes sustained when they were much younger And so it's for some of them, it could really limit their range of motion. And this is where the community really comes into play, because those were the elderly and the infirm were obviously taken care of by the group, which is another factor of this, of them, you know, being
having,
a lot more sophisticated.
Yeah, having some sort of culture. So it's not just like, oh, that one's hurt. We're going to leave him behind.
Yeah, we'll eat you later.
Yeah. And you can easily imagine, too, like a system where it's like, all right, the young guys, you guys haven't had your legs broken yet, so you're the ones who leap onto the ibex's back.
Right.
And your father and grandpa are going to stand back with the spears. You know, I'm just sort of imagining things, but it's easy to see how a system like this might work. Now, what happens, though, when climate change causes your forests to shrink and ends up creating this the steppe tundra environment, where suddenly you have more and more just vast, empty stretches of you know, no cover, where you can see the herds of reindeer or you know, ibex or whatever, but they're off in the distance. It's like, how are you gonna get that?
Right.
So you see,
and there's a lot of competition for that too, right?
And you see the emergence of persistence hunting, which there's an excellent sequence in the BBC Discovery documentary The Life of Mammals, where they show, because the final episode, they, you know, they get up to the mammal, humans, and they deal with sand people of the Kalahari Desert, the last tribe supposedly on Earth to use this ancient technique. And this is where humans use running and tracking to pursue prey just to the point of exhaustion. See, as humans, we of course can sweat, and we, you know, it reduces our body heat. But if you're chasing some sort of quadruped, this particular prey animal probably needs to slow down from a gallop to a pant. So I kind of think of it as the Terminator method of hunting, you know, where it's just like slow. You're not going to actually outrun the gazelle or whatever.
Right.
But you're just not going to stop. You're just going to follow it. It's not going to lose your trail, and you're just going to keep on and keep on until it literally falls down. You see the videos of this. It's like the animal just eventually collapses. And then the humans just walk up and finish it off. So the Neanderthals were not built for this.
Right.
Like this skill becomes the survival technique, and they're just physically generally not able to carry it out. There are also probably a lot of human populations that, around this time, that were equally unsuited for this new way of life, and they also went the way of any other species.
Right. It's not just the Neanderthals we're talking about.
Right. We're talking about a lot of, you know, it's like any kind of like changes in an economic situation, you know, like the economy changes. Oh, suddenly big bloated businesses can't survive. And, you know, maybe the little guys are going to do better. This is the same thing with the physicality.
Right. Right. I mean, there are other Homo erectus types out there at the same time. We're just focusing on Neanderthals, but there are other species existing out there at this time period that aren't making the cut either.
Yeah. And also, and again, it comes down to resources too. It's not a situation where humans were like, all right, we're here now, let's kill all the Neanderthals. You're talking about generations and generations of the landscape of human and humanoid populations changing.
Yeah.
Where the humans gradually outcompete the Neanderthals for resources. The Neanderthals end up being isolated in smaller and smaller areas, in more isolated areas until they are eventually to steal a phrase from a book we were just reading
by Clive Finlayson.
Yeah, they become the living dead, like a panda.
Yeah,
or a tiger. Though, in my opinion, far more interesting than a panda. But you know, they reach the point
not
where
not cute and cuddly though.
Yeah. Well, you don't know. Neanderthals could have been very cuddly.
Actually, what I think is funny about this early depictions of them made them look so caveman, man apish.
Yeah.
And now that we've had this understanding of them, much fuller understanding the last 5-10 years, they look so much more human-like.
Yeah, they have, like, our different wax depictions of them. Mm-hmm. They've gone from, like, you know, from, again, like, you know, slope-faced beast man to looking like just somebody you'd encounter, you know, on the street.
Yeah, now so. The depictions have, like, little bow ties on them.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's like fashion shoots and all. Yeah.
I like that. You need to tell W Magazine about that. So why us? Why did we persist?
It largely comes down to a situation of we were in the right place at the right time, really. We were better suited to roll with some of the changes that were coming down the pike.
Yeah.
If the changes had been a little different or occurred at a different time, it could have gone the other way.
And we could cover more territory, right? So we weren't as stocky or muscular.
Yeah, we were better suited to persistence hunting. We took to agriculture. We also eventually just got a better foothold on our population. Because again, you know, the Neanderthal population never got above like probably, 15,000.
Mm-hmm.
So a smaller population is always going to be more susceptible to extinction. And once you reach a certain size and in our case, once you reach a certain sophistication, you're really not going to deal with that as much unless, of course, you engineer your own extinction through, any number of ways that we're
actually Louise Leakey, the granddaughter of Mary Leakey, has an interesting TED talk, and she talks about that. She says, hey, like, don't get too much on your high horse, Homo sapiens, because we've only got 200,000 years of skin in the game.
Yeah.
And, you know, look at how our population has gone nuts and the resources that are dwindling. So don't get too excited here about the old continuation of our species.
Yeah. Yeah, because there's a lot of it comes down to geography, climate, and resources. And if you look at the state of human civilization, you can find some red flags really in all three of those areas.
Yeah.
And how are we going to roll with the changes?
Yeah, I know. I mean, yes, we have a dropped larynx, and it allows us to communicate in a more nuanced way, and we can teach each other in a more effective way than the Neanderthals. But yeah, what about climate change? What about smog?
Yeah, or
blooming onions,
and of course, there's always a chance that we may, eradicate ourselves with nuclear weapons. I don't think that's entirely off the table yet.
No,
as much as we would like to hope so.
But hey, there you go, Neanderthals.
Yeah, Planet Neanderthal. So I hope you might look at them a little differently the next time somebody mentions them, or the next time somebody slurs them. You know, stand up for your evolutionary brother. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and check out, if you'd like, the Max Planck Institute. They've got some really interesting information on the Neanderthal genome, and they have a really great video called The Neanderthal in Us.
Yeah, kind of like Tobias Funke is the man inside me. Right?
That's right, yeah.
Well, hey, we got some listener mail here.
Ooh.
Which I think I'll fly through here real quick. Our listener Eric writes in, and he's responding to our podcast, The Werewolf Principle, Engineering Humans for Outer Space, which was one I really enjoyed doing. And he says, it was interesting to hear about modifications to the body that might be made to help people fly in space. But you made two mistakes. First, deaf people would be able to use the radio, something that is a little bit critical to space flight. And I believe here he's referring to something we corrected in clarified in a previous listener mail. And that is that there are various forms of deafness.
Right.
And only one really falls under the model that was discussed in that podcast.
Which is to say not all deaf people would not suffer from.
From motion weirdness
in
space. But Eric goes on to add some really interesting stuff here. He says, you also missed a rather obvious, at least to me, point. Every person who has flown in space has carried 40 or 50 pounds of equipment with them that is not only completely useless in microgravity, but can even get in the way, their legs. A human leg, from hip to foot, including the foot, weighs about 20 to 30 pounds in a person in reasonable shape. As an amputee myself, I think amputees have been overlooked as astronauts, though I am not sure I'd be willing to have what's left of my legs removed for a chance to fly in space. I'm an SBK amputee. Anyway, great program, Eric. So that was some really interesting insight. I really had not thought as much about that, because you see shots of astronauts floating around, and indeed, it's not like they're using their toes to manipulate things.
Yeah, that's true.
Here's a brief note from listener Chris. He says, in reference to your podcast, Underground Robotic Highway, you stated that the driverless Google cars drove around San Francisco driverless. While technically that is true, there was a driver in the car to take control if needed. Love the podcast. Keep up the great work. And indeed, just to clarify, there was a driver, and these things were not just rolling around unattended. There was, you could think of it like a driver's ed class, where there's a human there in case something goes crazy.
Although I love the idea of, these going around like Lombard Street.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of like...
unattended.
Like, I believe David Sedaris pointed out that... is it Michigan where blind hunters can go out hunting alone?
I don't know, but I'm going to say that sounds very Michigan, as a Michiganer myself.
Yeah, so this is sort of like that. I have another one here from listener Jane. Jane says, I listened to your podcast about the Curies, and this is about scientists and love, and wanted to say thanks for a great show. My husband and I met as undergraduates at a nuclear and radiochemistry summer school put on by the Department of Energy. I am now working to finish my PhD in radiochemistry, and my husband is working as the reactor supervisor at our university's nuclear reactor. He has a master's degree in chemistry, and when I finish my time here, he will get his PhD. Considering how I met my husband, I have always loved the story of Marie and Pierre Curie. It was great to hear more personal side to their amazing scientific contributions. I love y'all's show. So there we go. There's some nice feedback from some listeners.
I know, and that just made me think I would love to see some MRI scans of scientists in love and compare them to the general population. I think that's
a
study
that
works.
Yeah, yeah, that would actually be a great a great art exhibit. I would go see that.
Yeah. All right. Someone out there. There you go.
So, hey, if you want to come see what we're up to, what we're thinking about, what we're writing about, what we're podcasting about, you can find us on Twitter and Facebook as Blow the Mind.
And you can also drop us a line at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. To learn more about the podcast, click on the podcast icon in the upper right corner of our homepage. The HowStuffWorks iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene! Eugene Fodor!
Gene, what's good?
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.